Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
Over and back, Classic NBA Podcast at HarvardProxism.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kreich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yes, we're going 90s.
We are.
In the I can't wait.
90s week. Yes, the fine decade of the 1990s. We've got a couple shows this week to cover 90s week for Harvard Paroxysm, so we're excited about that. And this is going to be a review of the 1995 season, which definitely some exciting things going on there. Middle of the decade, so you kind of get some of the trends from the early part matching the trends from the latter part. And good one to tackle, I think. So, and we have a great guest to tackle it with, a student of NBA history. He is the NBA editor at the Sporting News, Adi Joseph. Adi, welcome to the program.
Great. Honored to be here. And 1995 is a good year, so it's a good one to talk about.
Absolutely. And I think we'll kick it off with the discussion of the 1994-95 Rockets. They are the lowest seed ever to win an NBA Finals. They did so as a sixth seed. They were the first to beat four 50-plus game winners during the playoffs. The 2001 Lakers did it as well later on. Only 47-35. And this was the second championship for the team in as many years, but they were a significantly different team in the second years, highlighted by a big trade for getting Clyde Drexler from the Portland Trailblazers for Otis Thorpe. Those were the major players in that trade, and reuniting the Phi Slamma Jamma University of Houston, Hakeem and Clyde together again. And even though it didn't go that great in the regular season, it was outstanding in the postseason as the Clutch City Rockets managed to cast an upset in every round and beat some really impressive teams. Especially the Western Conference was very deep that year, and managed to win a championship. And even though people don't believe it, Michael Jordan did actually play in the NBA that season. So people who say that Michael Jordan wasn't there, not true. He was there. I think if I want people to learn nothing else from this podcast, I just want people to learn that Michael Jordan did play in the 1995 season and he lost in the playoffs. So
the other podcasts in the other years would just be, well, no one could beat Michael Jordan.
That was pretty much.
Yes. Pretty much the rest of the 90s were, Michael Jordan was really good at basketball. And this year was, I mean, we needed to only let him play 17 regular season games, but hey, someone beat Michael Jordan.
It counts. That's all I'm saying. It counts on the record. Let the record show. It's important. So, Rich, are you going to defend the Bulls' honor now, or do you want to?
No, I don't care. No, you know me. You know me. Okay. I love my Bulls or whatever. But yeah, I get a little annoyed by like the Jordan the godness of Jordan stuff. Where it's okay. You know, some people won when he wasn't. Whatever. Yeah, I don't care. They're fine. They had a good run. It was the year before that they had the really. I like that team a lot. Like that Bulls did the first post Jordan team the year prior to this was awesome because it was just like, how are they this good? Like they shouldn't be this good or whatever. And then this next year they came back and it was a little uneven or whatever. And of course Jordan comes back and they kind of got on a nice little path at the end and made a good little run. But yeah, I mean it was a team that needed some differences too. It's actually a very fitting team for what we're talking about because like you said, there's a lot of vestiges of like that prior Bulls team, and then what we knew is that there would be some little parts here and there of what that new Bulls team would become, and then it sort of took this year to sort of for them to reinvent themselves to what I think that next year was, and then we saw, you know, of course the insane dominance of, you know, 72 wins and all that stuff. But no, I won't I won't defend.
Good pat on the back there for, you know, good try for good old MJ this year. You know, didn't win, but he got a good try. Pat on the back, that's important. So Adi, what stands out to you for this this Rockets team?
Well, as I told you guys, Sam Cassell is my favorite basketball player of all time, and this was kind of the year for Sam to really make his. I mean, he obviously was on the previous year's team, but this year was a big stepping stone for him, where he became, even though, you know, Kenny Smith was still a fine starter, Sam Cassell became clearly their best point guard. And that's definitely stands out in my mind as an important thing. But the other one is, honestly, that Magic team was just so much fun. And I think, you know, for a lot of people around my age, maybe a little bit younger, maybe a little older, that Shaq and Penny combination is a defining moment in NBA history.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really, they both came into the league around the same time. We're about the same age. Shaq fit all of the great, you know, big man tropes, and Penny, you know, looked, if you squinted, you kind of saw another Magic in there, at least in terms of, you know, being a great point guard at a similar size, having some of the same skill set. So, you definitely, you know, there was the foundations of that as well. They also had, you know, some other pretty good, they got Horace Grant from the Bulls. They also had Dennis Scott, who is a knockdown shooter and one of the better 3-point shooters in the league during that time. You know, they had, you know, kind of a nice mix of, and a foundation of really young guys, kind of like, you know, Oklahoma City in the in recent years with Durant and Westbrook. It's obviously, you know, a parallel that's going on, or even with the Warriors now. I mean, just having a group of guys, you know, two core pieces who at the time of these finals were 22 and 23. That's a pretty magical thing.
Yeah, I think that's the most significant thing that I take away from this Rockets season in general, is that they get to the finals and they sweep this Magic team. And it was like, you know, going back and watching, I was watching some videos and documentaries and stuff about the Rockets team, and the build up to the Magic that year was like, oh my, this team is already so good, and that guy's 22 and he's dominating the league and leading the league in scoring, and he's a rebounding machine, he's breaking backboards or whatever, and then this guy's 23 and he looks like Magic Johnson and he plays like Magic. It's just like, man, like you have to think, like, there's no way this team loses, there's no way this team doesn't at least maybe push it to 7 games and lose in a heart. But they get swept by this Rockets team, and this Rockets team had trouble all, it was like they just never, it wasn't until this last little rally that it seemed like everything kind of got together for the Rockets. Because I mean, we'll talk about it here in a little bit, but it was pretty uneven the whole year. And then even when you get Drexler, there's still some kind of stuff going, and then it's just like, for whatever reason, the playoffs came, and then like they blow, you know, they beat the Jazz, who were great. They beat the Spurs, who were great. Or they beat the, who am I blanking in between there? Oh, the Suns, yeah. Right. The Suns in between. And then you get to the Spurs or whatever. And then it's like, geez, they've gone through all this. And now you have to face the 22 and 23 year olds. And you guys are a bunch of old, you know, and that's the thing too, is like, it's kind of an older team, the Rockets, at that point, where you're coming up against this buzzsaw of like all these young dudes that it's like, oh my God, these guys are going to just dominate the league for the next decade or whatever. And then they just sweep them. And it's just like, oh, okay. Like, huh. It's just, it's unique. It's just so weird that like it almost seems impossible that they were able to do that.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, we shouldn't devalue the Rockets that much because
they're
defending champions. And they did have Hakeem, but they had stumbled so much, and the Drexler trade, which I think we'll talk about a little more in more detail soon, it was a big thing. One of the really interesting things about the Rockets team was that the NBA had shorter 3-point lines in the mid-90s for 3 seasons, and the Rockets were the team that took advantage. Rudy Tomjanovich was the one who really, the coach who really most clearly realized, if they're going to move the line in a little bit, I'm going to have my guys, and I believe it was 22 feet all the way around instead of having a wider arc. It basically, he was the guy who said, all right, let's just have Vernon Maxwell and Robert Horry and Kenny Smith and Mario Elie and all those guys, all the guys on the team, basically, except for Hakeem, were taking 3-pointers. And that was a big part of their genius the previous season. And some people, I think, kind of thought they might have taken it too far in 95 because they jacked their 3-point rate up even higher. Remember, this is an era when taking too many threes was a thing.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, even this era, it's still people get bothered by it, even though, you know, it's been pretty proven effective at this point. But there is the worry just of like of that balance being, you know, off in an aesthetic way and in somewhat of, you know, teams that aren't the Warriors way. But you know, as you mentioned, you know, there was a lot of turmoil during the year. I mean, right before the Drexler trade, actually 8 days before, Vernon Maxwell attacked a fan in Portland, was suspended for 10 games. Then the trade is made. So Thorpe leaves the team. He was the number two minutes leader for the 94 Rockets and also, you know, very much a fan favorite, a glue guy for the team. Then Vernon Maxwell failed to show for practice after the trade, and he was the number three minutes leader on the team. He did play down the stretch of the season, but later on he was suspended/left the team, depending on who you talk to, after one game in the playoffs. Didn't play after that, so he was gone after that. So they managed to, you know, put together this this run through the playoffs. Without, you know, two of their really key players. Of course, they had Drexler, who gets, when he's traded, gets a, you know, conquering hometown hero around halftime. Shortly after halftime, you know, he and Tracy Murray fly another guy who's part of the trade, and just, you know, arrives this big standing ovation, and there's just so much excitement for it. But you know, the weird thing is that they played actually quite a bit better before the trade than they did after the trade. Before the trade, they were 30-17, they had a 3.2 net rating, and then after the trade, it was 17-18 record with a 0.9 net rating. And, you know, Hakeem missed a couple weeks there, Ori missed about a month there, so there's certainly that, and just, you know, some of the chemistry things that you have to work out when you add a piece like Drexler. And Drexler did, you know, he was able to kind of carry a lot of the scoring load while Hakeem was gone. They managed to be 3-5 during that stretch that he was gone, so, you know, he kind of held it together. But it's, you would not, you know, looking at how they played after the trade, there was really nothing in there that would make you think, oh yeah, they can win the championship at this point. I mean, it seemed like, at least at that point, they were pretty much just hanging on.
Yeah, I think, you know, Clyde kind of gets underrated a little bit historically because people remember him so, like, people, I think in a lot of people's minds, he played a lot longer in Houston than he did. And the truth is, he was, now I don't want to say washed up, because he was still a very good player for his last 3.5 seasons, but he was nowhere near as efficient and as dominant as he was in Portland when he got to the Rockets. And that 3-point change really didn't suit his game. That was not who Clyde Drexler kind of wanted to be, I don't think. And because, you know, he was more of a slasher. The shorter 3-point range really helped the guys who were good at long twos. And Clyde did a lot to improve himself for the next season, and the Rockets were, you know, a lot better in a lot of ways with the following season than they were in the half season that they played with Clyde in 94-95. But that was not the best point. That was not the best version of Clyde Drexler. And if you had combined him and Hakeem in 92, someone might have beaten Jordan, you know?
Yeah. And that would have been, I mean, Drexler absolutely at his peak. And then, you know, Hakeem, he would have, because he's like 32, 33 at this point, too. I mean, he's getting older. He's still, I mean, he's obviously playing it at an immaculate level. But yeah, both those guys at age 28 together, that would have obviously been an incredible thing. So their playoff run to repeat as champions, they were down in both the first two rounds. They were down 2-1 against the Jazz. It was back when it was a 5-game series. The Rockets managed to rally. Drexler helped lead a Game 5 win in Salt Lake City after the Rockets were down 7 late in the game. There's a great Houston Press oral history of this team, and one, there's a quote from Rudy T, who said, you know, there are so many situations when I go back through that title run where I say, how in the hell did we do that? And game five in Houston was the first moment there. In the second round, they're down to the Suns 3-1. And this is the, the Jazz or the Stockton Malone, you know, really, you know, I think that might have, they've actually been their best regular season. And then, they're down to Charles Barkley's Suns, you know, who had been there a couple years, been to the finals a couple years ago, still really good. And they were down 3-1, but they managed to win in seven. And before game seven, Drexler was in bed all day with 102 degree fever and hooked up to an IV and basically didn't really know where he was and what he was doing during the game. Didn't score, but managed to get contributions from Mario Elie and Chucky Brown, who Chucky Brown had two interesting things about him. He had joined the team initially on a 10-day contract and then had another one, then was there for the rest of the season, then had a guaranteed contract the next season. That was a big plus for him after the finals happened. They basically said, we'll take care of you. And he is tied for the record with most teams played in NBA history with 12. So good old Chucky Brown. This is the big thing, big moment I think is best remembered in this series is the Mario Elie game winner and the followed by the kiss of death afterwards, sort of his famous signature. I think that was game six of the series. I don't remember off the top of my head, but that was, one of the key moments that led to the Rockets winning the series. Any memories, Adi, from these first two series that stand out?
You know, you brought up Chucky Brown, and I actually was sitting next to him at a Hornets game pretty recently, and I was talking to him about this team, and what he said was his number one thing with this team was it was the most businesslike, without a question, team that he had ever played for, especially with Clyde. And, it was a situation where Rudy T and Hakeem had built that level of trust so that a guy like Elie could take that key shot. And a guy like Sam Cassell had big moments, and Robert Horry, and all of those players, probably more than most other teams in NBA, even championship teams in NBA history, this team had just a diverse set of guys who played big roles. And Chucky Brown was certainly one of those guys. He started a lot of games, and 14 games it looks like, and you know, that I think was a core factor in what made this team special, was they really believed in everyone on the court, and it showed in that run, because like you said, they were facing some, in those first two rounds, they're facing, you know, at least what, four Hall of Famers, two on each team, if there weren't even more on the Suns at that point, and a couple great coaches in Jerry Sloan and Paul Westphal, and they were, in all honesty, and on paper, I'm sure looking back, it might seem crazy to say this about the defending champions, but they were underdogs.
Absolutely, and I think one of the, you kind of stole my point that I was going to say about this, especially these two rounds, is it's so vivid when you watch, you know, videos back and watch, you know, documentaries or whatever, when they're talking about this team. In those two games, the big highlights they show, there's not much Hakeem in there. We'll talk about the next series where Hakeem really does, you know, the heavy lifting, but it's really cool how you see guys, like you said, Amaro Elie is hitting a bunch of big shots. Robert Horry is hitting a bunch of big shots. Sam Cassell is hitting a bunch of big shots. Chucky Brown's hitting a bunch. It's like these other guys that you talk about and you look at, and it's like, yeah, there's a certain level of every champion needs, like that one random, you know, a random guy here and there to hit a big shot. You know, your John Paxson's of the world to hit these big shots. But you watch these series, you watch these highlights, and you go, man, like these guys, each and every time when it was like they needed a big shot, a big run, something like that, it was one of these guys that you've met, like, are just sort of like, well, like, we know Horry now and we know Cassell now, but these are babies at this time. And like, and they were, you know, relied upon and trusted to make these big shots, to be in these big positions, to be in the game at this time. And I think that's a testament to Hakeem, as you said, sort of building that foundation, and also Rudy T doing that as well, of building that sort of foundation of a team where, yeah, a Chucky Brown can come from a 10-day contract and play big minutes and start for a team that's about to, you know, embark on a championship run, which is crazy to think about. But it's really vivid in, I think, these two rounds. And then we see that next round where Hakeem kind of says, okay, well, now I'm going to do some work here against the Spurs. But that's a discussion that has been had by many, many people.
Yeah, yes. I think there is one thing. Like, Hakeem was averaging 30-plus points a game in these series. He averaged 30.
Oh, no, he was great, yeah.
What it is, I think that this is part of what building around a center is. You know that a center needs to be able to draw the double team, and very few centers are going to, against really good double teams that where Karl Malone is the number two guy on the double team, most centers are not going to want to or be good at scoring against that. So what Hakeem did in those two series was dominated early, forced consistent double teams, and then hit those guys who were taking advantage of that shorter three-point line.
Yeah, and in the I looked it up because I forgot to look up the specifics, but the Jazz had 60 wins, the Suns had 59 wins, and then the Spurs had 62 wins. So the Magic had 57. So I sort of undersold it when I said they beat 450 plus game winners. I mean, they really beat 457 plus game winners. So that's obviously quite remarkable. Specifically the Spurs series. Hakeem averaged 35 points, 12.5 rebounds, 5 assists, 1.3 steals, and 4.2 blocks per game on 56% shooting. Robinson, in most series, has to be pretty good. 23.8 points, 11.3 rebounds, 2.7 assists, 1.5 steals, and 2.2 blocks on 45% shooting. So, Robinson didn't exactly do terribly, but Hakeem obviously, a dominant series. And that was inspired by the MVP trophy presentation to Dave Robinson before game two. And then Drexler talks about like how everyone was kind of like riling Hakeem up and saying, and he said the nerve of them giving him your trophy right before this game. And he said, I stomped away like I was disappointed and Dream grabbed me by the arm before I could walk away. And he said, do not worry, we will get the big trophy. I felt really good at that point. So
I guarantee that's an exact quote. Like that, I could see Hakeem saying that exact word. Like yes. When you said that, I read it in his voice too. Of like that's exactly
the Houston press oral history had that as well. So and there I haven't seen all of it, but there's also a great NBA TV documentary on this that came out I think in the last year or so, fairly recently. Talking about it as well. Have either of you guys seen it or?
I think I have. Yeah, I don't recall right off the top of my head, but I'm almost positive I have seen that because I think that's what I was. I don't know 100%, but I'm almost positive. But like you were saying, David Robinson had, what you would say is good games, but it was more like the optics and the narrative of him just getting pulverized. You know what I mean?
Clearly he did. I mean, he got out played. I mean, right.
But it's sort of like, sometimes you would be like, that's not bad numbers. But like, it was the optics that Hakeem just went and just shoved it down his throat.
We've talked about before how Robinson's career really, I think, is stained by his performance there. And it's a little bit unfair, but at the same time, Hakeem did really, wreck him pretty well in the series.
I think, one of the differences is what I was saying, when you have Joe Klein as your starting center, you double Hakeem.
Yeah,
and you think when you have David Robinson as your starting center that you don't need to double Hakeem, and you always need to double Hakeem, and maybe that played a little bit into the Spurs. We see all those highlights of Hakeem just using all of his unbelievable creativity in the post and his footwork and just basically spinning around and doing what he wanted, even against a great all-time great player in David Robinson, and you wonder, maybe they should have been double teaming because that sure didn't work to let him guard him one on one, even though you had, the MVP, a guy who actually deserved that MVP, I might add.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And a guy regarded as a great player, but probably not, as much as he should be. But so going to the finals themselves, again, it was a sweep. I believe only the sixth final sweep in NBA history. Rockets were actually down by 20 in the first game, which I actually remember watching. I remember well watching this game. The Rockets made a big rally. The Magic had a chance to win, but then Nick Anderson famously missed four free throws in a row. And then Kenny Smith after that hit a three-pointer to tie, and then the Rockets won in overtime on Hakeem tip-in at the buzzer. And there were some close games in the series. It wasn't like they necessarily just, you know, walked all over them in the finals, but obviously, you know, at that point, it's you know, when you get swept, you can only be in it for so much. So you know, definitely an impressive win. And as we mentioned before, the Rockets are playing against this really promising Magic team in the finals. Hakeem is 32.8, 11.5, 5.5 assists, two steals and two blocks. Shaq with 28 points, 12.5 rebounds, 6.3 assists, and 2.5 blocks. So statistically, they matched up a little bit better. And but, you know, as I said, the well-rounded, more veteran team seemed to pull it out. And, you know, other than game three being pretty close, the other games were not necessarily all that close. So anything else? Obviously, the Nick Anderson free throws, which we had to mention, even though I know there were some people who were begging us not to mention them.
you have to.
anything else stand out for you guys as far as these finals go?
I think we were robbed a little bit because, you know, as we said, the previous year's Rockets team was better, and the Knicks got dragged that team out to seven games. And I mean that was the year that Reggie Miller did his whole thing against the Knicks in the playoffs, and that eliminated the Knicks in the second round of the Eastern Conference playoffs, and led to the Magic beating the Pacers in the Eastern Conference Finals. It's almost a little bit of a shame that we didn't get to see a second Ewing Olajuwon matchup there, because it probably would not have been a sweep at the very least.
Yeah, even though, you know, the matchup of Hakeem and Shaq is that has that magical quality, and it was certainly competitive during the series. But right, it was not, obviously we only got four games, so it couldn't have been that magical.
It was almost almost like a scarring moment. It was like a necessary scar on Shaq's career. Like, oh, you think you're good? You think you're really good? Yeah, Hakeem just owned you. And that was a defining moment that I think kind of maybe helped drive him a little bit toward bettering himself, which we know Shaq was not always the best at finding that motivation. But that kind of drove him into what became his best seasons, which were 99, 2000, and 2001. Without that memory of Hakeem just owning him, maybe he doesn't work as hard to get better.
Sure. And you wonder if that, you know, if you know, the Rockets win this series 4-2, if that changes the calculus on anyone, you know, as far as Shaq goes, as far as having confidence in the Magic, or you know, changing him leaving for LA. I mean, that's impossible to know. Maybe that doesn't make that much of a difference, but you have to, I think it does pay to wonder. Obviously getting smashed by the Bulls in 96, it was a big one as well, but I having two of those strong, you know, being swept in playoff series to clearly superior teams, you know, had to have something, and this is obviously the first one. All right, anything else about the Rockets before we move on to other topics?
No, I think I'm good.
Yeah, that 2 year run was special. It's also a shame on top of the Knicks that they didn't get to play the Bulls, because if they had, I mean, the Bulls didn't have Rodman yet, and they didn't have Grant anymore, and the Rockets probably could have beaten the Bulls, but it's a shame that we didn't get to see MJ potentially lose. See what MJ does when he has even less help in a finals. That would have been an awesome experience.
Yeah. The Rockets basically had another couple of years of, you know, of playoff contention. They lost in the Western Conference semis the next year. In 97, they got Barkley, and they made it all the way to the Western Conference Finals and lost in six to the Jazz. Beat the Sonics in a pretty classic seven-game series in the semifinals. So that was kind of the rest of the run for those teams. After that, they, you know, they started aging, and they tried Pippen Pippen, Olajuwon, and Barkley, and that fizzled, and then they moved on to the next era of the team and got some bad jerseys in the meantime. I'm glad that they did not make a finals with those jerseys, because that would have been an abomination.
It's always the worst part about the Jazz, is that they made their big run with those jerseys. It's like, I get so irrationally angry about that. Like, I was watching videos of this and I was like, oh, those Jazz uniforms were so good. And then they got so much success with those crappy uniforms.
Yeah, the Sonics too. The Sonics had the bad ones in 96.
Oh, yeah.
You have some interesting 1995 stats to throw at us.
Yeah, so let's look at a few things here. Real quick, MVP David Robinson, he was third in points per game, seventh in rebounds per game, fourth in blocks per game, 10th in steals, first in free throws, first in win shares per 48, first in box score plus minus, first in value of a replacement player, first in PR, and first in HBox, which is the new Nylon Calculus stat. So as Adi said, yeah, he is a very, very deserving MVP candidate that year. Some other notables, points per game, Shaq led the league at 29.3. Rebounds per game, Rodman at 16.8. Assists per game, Stockton, John Stockton at 12.3. Steals per game, Scottie Pippen, 2.9. And then blocks per game, of course, Dikembe Mutombo at 3.9. Some other notables, Seattle Supersonics, their SRS was 7.91, which is actually the 23rd best in the three-point era. So it was a really, really good team that year as well. We haven't really mentioned much of them. The Shaq, he led the league in two-pointers by 111 over Karl Malone. So he had plenty of points for himself. This is an interesting one. Dikembe Mutombo, he didn't lead the league in offensive rebounds or defensive rebounds, but he had an overall lead in total rebounds by 128 this year as well, which is nice and fun. John Stockton, he led the league in assists by a mere 331. Kenny Anderson was second, so nice job, Kenny, but sorry. And then as far as like changes, of course, we talk about this year, and we'll talk a little bit about this in a little bit, but in terms of changes in pace and style, of course, the three-point line getting shortened for with the goal of increasing scoring didn't really work all that well. Didn't increase overall scoring all that much. Points per game actually continued the drop. They went to 101.4 this year. And that was after being as high as a 107 in the 1990, actually. So, yeah, points per game were continuing sort of to plummet. Pace fell as well. Went down to down from 2.2 from 1994 and down 5.4 from 1990. So we saw as the decade was sort of getting older, pace was falling, points per game were falling. And the good news, though, attendance rose by over 20,000 league-wide per team. So, you know, that's up a tremendous mark, even from 1990. It's up 47,000. From 1990. So the NBA was just getting ungodly popular at this point. And we all know that. And it's just incredible to see how big it was.
And that's interesting because, of course, most of the season was without the Jordan, you know, and that was a worry. That was always a worry that, you know, with Jordan being gone and, of course, you know, Bird and Magic had retired, you know, a couple years before that for each. So the fact that the attendance was up during that time is interesting.
It is, and it's the first year without, you know, like you said, it's that first year or the first another big year without all those guys. Like you're talking about, like a Bird, a Magic, or whatever. And there was a little bit of a fall the year prior, but this year then it increased over that. And like I said, up 47,000 over 1990. So it was obviously the NBA was just blowing up in popularity with or without Jordan. It would only get even more when Jordan did come back. So cool to know.
I think one thing that stands out to me there is that Sonics number, and you just think, like, if Jordan doesn't come back and we don't get the greatest team ever, that next year we could have seen the Sonics and the Magic play in the finals, and that would have been not only a really cool matchup between two up-and-coming teams, but it also would have been, like, the most 90s moment in the history of...
Sean Kemp. Hardaway, like, come on, dunking out one another, and like, you're like, oh man, these guys are gonna rule the NBA for the next decade. Magic and Sonics, like, who could stop these guys?
You could not get any more 90s than a 1996 Sonics Magic final,
especially those hideous fucking uniforms,
green,
red, and God, so mad about
at them. Least the Magic would have looked good, you know.
Yes,
I've always enjoyed those. I know you're not a big fan of the pinstripes, Rich, but you know, what? I. Yeah, Rich is anti-pinstripes in all forms, even even for the Magic. It's, you know, we love Rich despite this.
I'm a Yankees fan, so I have some strong disagreements there. But
well, that's fair. Yeah, I get that. That's fair. But yeah, we had a whole podcast about pretty much like 90% of the podcast we talked about jerseys was me getting or Jason getting mad at me for not liking pinstripes.
I don't know if it goes so far to say I was mad at you. I was just.
Oh, I think you were
actually
mad.
Maybe befuddled, perhaps.
Pissed.
But
you were pissed.
You know, one thing that the fact that that pace dropped so much in the 90s, and I mean, I know part of it is the changes in defensive style with the Pistons and later the Knicks, you know, sort of enabling, you know, kind of a grinded out slower league. And I guess the other thing is that you pretty much most of the successful teams by the mid 90s are all, you know, older teams, like the Magic obviously being a notable exception, but you know, the Rockets are pretty old, the Jazz are pretty old, the Bulls are pretty old, the Knicks are, you know, are aging. I mean, all these teams are in their, you know, their main players are in their mid early 30s. And I wonder if I think most players, it's true, as they get older, they tend to play slower, and I wonder how much that had to do with it as well, especially with, you know, kind of the 89 through 91, 92 drafts. So some of those years, not the restocking of talent kind of took a while. There were exceptions, obviously Shaq, for instance, but you know, those drafts were kind of weak. The superstars, Jordan and those guys were kind of unable to hold on a little bit because of there wasn't quite as much talent in like a 4-year period kind of coming into the league. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that, but that just occurred to me discussing this.
You're right that between 1985 and 1992, the draft caliber was weak. I mean, we barely even think of Larry Johnson as a bust, and the guy was not all that good for a number one pick. You know, David Robinson took forever to get to the NBA, and you know, 4 years in college, 2 years in the Navy, and it was a bizarre time for the NBA draft, and you had guys like, you know, Purvis Ellison, who was a hotshot as a freshman at Louisville, would have declared no brainer after winning the championship as a freshman. He comes out after his senior year, and he's a pretty low key, you know, number one pick. Derek Coleman and Danny Manning certainly had talent, but had their problems that didn't lead them to maximize it. So what we had in 94, 95 was a group of guys who we didn't quite get. They weren't quite ready, like Chris Webber and Jason Kidd and Grant Hill. They were in the league. They just weren't quite ready to maximize it. And then what we saw in the 95, 96, 97, 98 drafts was just an overload of talent that kind of carried us into the 2000s.
Yeah, absolutely. And a number of those guys, of course, were, you know, pretty young or high school. Yeah, that 95, of course, with Garnett is when high school. So it did take a little bit for some of that talent. That was a younger crop in general, and maybe took a couple of those guys a little bit of time to mature as well, you know, longer than you would have expected in, you know, the previous 5 to 10 years. So it's an interesting mix of how that all kind of worked out.
Yeah, actually, this would be a good time to talk about the Rookie of the Year race, which is one of my favorites, the 94-95 Jason Kidd and Grant Hill. I mean, Jason Kidd came out after his sophomore year, and you kind of saw, man, this guy's super talented, but he's still got some things to work out. Grant Hill, on the other hand, have we ever seen a player, a wing player like that, just come in and be so polished? I mean, even Magic Johnson, who was better, still had a long way to go. Grant comes in and he just looks like he's ready to play as an NBA player on day one.
Yeah, and he was such a smooth player too. And really, looking back at some of the video, I mean, even like more like athletic and fierce than I remember. I mean,
oh, yeah.
He was just such a great dunker and just such a, you know, kind of always made the right play, but was flashier than you know, than I think people remember. Obviously, you know, the post-injury Grant Hill, you know, being the more recent Grant Hill that people probably remember a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, he was absolutely, you know, really well and fully formed and just a really a crisp player. And Kidd was, you know, really just kind of the engine that those Mavs needed. I mean, they improved from 13 to 36 wins that year and looked like they were going to be a team on the rise with Kidd and Jamal Mashburn and Jim Jackson all together, that core being together and those guys seeming like they would play pretty well together, but that did not work out. Those guys were all pretty much gone in the next two years. And, but yeah, I mean, Grant by 0.1 points per game, he missed out on a 25-5 rookie season, which I think like Oscar Robertson and a couple other guys, Jordan, and I think one other guy managed to accomplish in his career. But yeah, what was really stout. And it's funny because they apparently Dan Patrick switched his vote from Kidd to Grant Hill at the last minute, leading to a tie. Otherwise, Kidd would have won the Rookie of the Year award. But that's there have actually been a decent number of co-award winners. There was both in the NBA and the ABA in 1971. There were co-rookies of the year, Jeff Petrie and Dave Cowens in the NBA and Charlie Scott and Dan Issel in the ABA. In 1975, there were co-ABA MVPs, George McGinnis, Julius Erving. And in 2000, there were co-rookies of the year, Elton Brand and Steve Francis. So it's happened the most with the Rookie of the Year. Actually, I guess it's happened the most with the All-Star MVP. There were four times it's happened, most recently by Shaq and Kobe in 2009. And the funny thing about Hill and Grant is that they not only started at the same time, but they ended up retiring 2 days apart as well. So I thought that was always a nice bit of a juxtaposition there.
Yeah, you know, I have a funny little Grant Hill thing, which is anytime I cover an NBA game and I'm eating the meal, I pretty much always drink Sprite. Because I just associate it with the NBA, and I don't ever drink Sprite otherwise. But the one time, it's like I associate Sprite and the NBA thanks to Grant Hill and his fillas. Yeah.
when you're all sweaty, there's nothing like cracking open a when you're sweaty after playing basketball. Nothing like cracking open a Sprite.
Yeah.
to really quench the thirst there. I don't.
Grant Hill drinks.
I remember
Sprite,
trying that, and it was like not good. Like
yeah,
that's the worst. Like I would play basketball and like because like you had to because Grant Hill drank Sprite after he played games, so why couldn't I? And like it was always terrible. Like I burped a lot, and I was like, "This is not good.
No,
like why don't I
do this?
This
is not, yeah, not a good idea.
Why would Grant Hill lie to me? He's such a nice guy.
I know." Yeah, another important Grant Hill also accomplished another important feat in 1995.
Yeah, he was the first rookie in pro sports to lead fan balloting for the All-Star game, which is very interesting. He beat Shaq by about 26,000 votes, so not, you know, slim, but not insanely slim. But yeah, it's pretty crazy that he was able to do that. Grant Hill, of course, came into the league with a lot of the hype from Duke. I know he mentioned that as well in some quotes. He thought, you know, it's probably a lot the fact that I was, you know, a big star in college and a Duke player, but still to beat Shaq, you know, that prime Shaq at that point is pretty interesting as well. And that All-Star game in general, we'll talk a little bit about that All-Star game here in a sec, but he's one of five players, all from the Eastern Conference, that were making their All-Star debuts. There was Anthony Hardaway, of course. Penny was making his first. He was the top vote getter amongst guards, and he joined Grant Hill in the starting lineup. You also had Vin Baker of the Milwaukee Bucks, Dana Barros of the 76ers, and of course, who can forget Tyron Hill of the Cleveland Cavaliers, made his All-Star game debut here. And what was interesting is the last two names didn't even appear on the All-Star ballot. So I don't know what was going on that year. People were just loving the rookies that year. I don't know. But yeah, it's very interesting for Grant Hill to do that for that All-Star game. And he remains one of the four rookies to make the All-Star team in the last 20 years. And that's Tim Duncan, Yao Ming, and Blake Griffin. So it's not something that happens often. But Hill not only made it in his first year, but also led the fan balloting. So that's a really awesome thing for Grant Hill. And a lot of that, you know, of course, will come, like I said, from his Duke years. But he was well-deserving as well. Like Adi mentioned, he was so, like, unlike any other player, I think I can remember. Even LeBron James, we remember, like, there was a weirdness, you know, where he's still kind of trying to figure himself out. Grant Hill, like, walked into the league and was just like, yeah, I'll score 20 and get, you know, 7 rebounds. And it was like, all right, cool, thanks. Like, you know, there was nothing, you didn't have to do anything with the guy. He was just ready to go. And it's so unique.
Yeah, I think what made Grant special was 4 years under Coach K with a lot of talented players around him. He just knew how to be an NBA player.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was able to sort of also be the, you know, the transition for the Pistons from the Bad Boys days. Joe Dumars was sort of the only guy left from there. There's actually a pretty good SI article from Phil Taylor from later on in the rookie season about sort of their, you know, mentorship. Relationship, even though Dumars is basically like, yeah, you know, he doesn't need, you know, he's a guy who doesn't really need, you know, mentor. And it had some interesting things about sort of the generation gap and about how Dumars didn't really feel like he connected with the some of the younger players, and it felt like some of the attitudes with more money and just of sort of the image that, you know, was something he didn't really understand, but Grant was sort of a guy that he did understand. And then Grant started talking about where he was a little bit uncomfortable with that image of being the, you know, the good guy. He says he doesn't have, it isn't something he created. It's not something I feel like I have to live up to. I know that, but sometimes I need to be reminded of it. So that was a good, you know, relationship to the, between them.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Go ahead.
I actually had a interview with Grant last year, and it was for a story I did on Kobe and the concept of the next Michael Jordan. And when I was talking to Grant, I could almost hear in his voice he hated being portrayed as that and being a new age, being portrayed as a new age player and being portrayed as a clean cut image. He very much wanted to be his own player, but when you spend 4 years at Duke and you've got this clean-cut image and you're the son of an NFL player and you're, you know, you have a very unique style of play that we hadn't really seen much of, I think he got thrusted into being sort of like the good guy version of the next Michael Jordan, and I'm not sure he ever wanted that, but it was it was a time when, I mean, even in that era and when he came into the league, remember, Michael Jordan wasn't around. So even though he ended up playing five and a half seasons with Michael Jordan in the league at the time, for when Grant Hill walked into the league, we were looking for the next Michael Jordan because we didn't know he'd come back. So, you know, it was a burden he kind of had to carry. Was he was kind of the easiest fit for that role.
All right, I had mentioned the All-Star game, and we can't do the 94-95 season without talking about those All-Star jerseys and the ones, the historic Phoenix All-Star jerseys. Here's a quote from Ryan Bort from Esquire. It's nice that the NBA wanted to make the 1995 All-Star jersey specific to the year's host city, but a huge cartoon cactus on the front? You're damn right. The 1995 jerseys are ugly, sure, but they're so objectively objectionable, it's hard 20 years later not to find them a little bit charming. If you see someone rocking one of these throwbacks in the street, tip your cap. And I absolutely agree. These are, they're like hideous, but it's like so 1995 that like, you're like, you know, yeah, like the next year, I think was even more hideous, the one in San Antonio. Yes. But this one, like you got the very cartoony cactus. It's got like the little like green, like everybody loved like little triangles. Like the designs had to be like colorful triangles. Like any Knicks show, like was just filled. The logo just had like colored triangles around it. This one had that too. It's just, they're so 1995, and I just couldn't do this podcast without talking about them and making people, at least if you don't know what we're talking about right by me saying it, at least go search them out and just see. There's one picture. It's like Dikembe, Patrick Ewing, and so I forgot who else. And it's just the best picture ever because they're like purple and gaudy, and there's just terrible designs, and it's so 1995, and it's just so perfect.
I will stand by. I think the San Antonio ones the next year were even worse, but...
Oh, those are hideous. No, those are like these, like Ryan said here, those are like, there's some sort of charm to these ones. Like they're okay. You know, there's the fun little cactus or whatever. Those next years are horrendous. Those are just really, really awful.
Yeah. And I find bad All-Star jerseys far less objectionable than bad regular uniforms because you don't have to see them all the time. You know, the All-Star jerseys are one and done. So, you know, if they're bad, who cares? But if they're, but you know, if you have to see them all the time for, you know, at least a few years, it's going to wear on you. So I'm willing to go along with this line of thought as long as, again, it's sort of like one night thing. But so a few big moments of the of 1995 that we should get to, historic landmarks. Lenny Wilkins broke Red Auerbach's record. to become the all-time wins leader. He was the coach of the Hawks at the time. They beat the they beat the then Bullets still in Atlanta. Red was on hand, and Wilkins even took a few puffs from a cigar in tribute to Red. He ended up with he cleared 939 victories, and then Wilkins finished his career with a 1,332. That is second all time. Don Nelson passed that with only three more wins. So there's a decent chance for some coaches to pass that mark. Although it will definitely take a lot of work. Probably Popovich, I think, would have the best chance. But he's still, you know, at least a couple hundred away from that record. So we'll see. Another big moment. Moses Malone retired. He was the last active ABA player in the league. In fact, he retired with an ABA team, the Spurs. He played 17 games with the Spurs that season. David Robinson, of course, being on that team. Some of his other teammates were Avery Johnson, Dennis Rodman, Chuck Person, and Doc Rivers. So a fun little crew of characters there. Vinny Del Negro as well, J.R. Reed, Terry Cummings, and John Elliott. So a mix of guys. Many of them still are either coaching or have media roles in the league. And his final game was December 27th, 1994. So he didn't play that. He actually didn't play into 1995 technically, but it's part of the season, so we're going to count it. And he, in his final game, he made a nearly full court shot from the opposite free throw line against the Hornets, and it was the 8th three pointer of his career. he was 4th all time in points. Now he is 7th. He's about to be passed by Dirk, and 3rd all time in rebounds. So great career. Obviously, we have a whole show dedicated to Moses when he unfortunately passed away. But he notably was the last active ABA player. A couple others I'll just go through real quick. Final game in Boston Garden. It was torn down after the season to. It took a while for it to torn down, but they moved to the TD Garden. And the famous for its parquet floor and its very rough conditions. The last official basket there was by Horace Grant in Game 4 of Orlando's win against Boston on May 5th, 95. It dated back there to 1928, and the Celtics debuted there in 1946. So. And then one more, John Stockton replacing Magic Johnson as the NBA's all-time assist leader. He did it on February 1st of 95, passing 9,922. Record breaker came on a baseline jumper from Karl Malone. He actually did it in 14 fewer games than Magic did. The game was halted, and he was given a game ball and congratulated by his teammates and family. The governor and Senator Orrin Hatch were there. And after the game, he gave a thank you speech, and he finished his career with 15,806 assists, second to Jason Kidd, is second with 12,091, which is about so he's about 76% of the assists that Stockton has. So if you took that percentage of Kareem's 3,800 points, it would equal about the amount that Dirk has right now, about 29,000 points. And Dirk is 8th all time in points at the moment. So the distance and scale of how much Stockton is ahead of his competition is quite staggering. So,
yeah, you have here in the notes that I'm looking at, you have Chris Paul as the best chance to break it. And I'm thinking to myself, like, D'Angelo Russell might have the best chance.
Yes, Chris Paul is about half the fewer than half the assists that Stockton had in his career at this moment. So
yeah, some 14-year-old somewhere in
you're probably right, but as far as anyone nearly in that with that mark, that is LeBron is somewhere around like 6,600. So I guess although he probably not gonna play that long. I think he'll play a while, but probably not quite that long. So
The other one that the other thing that you mentioned, there's sort of a symmetry to Moses Malone and Dominique Wilkins, who were teammates for a little while. And one thing I always loved about them was at the end of their career, they bounced around a lot. And in a way, they kind of gave a whole lot of franchises like the Milwaukee Bucks and the Washington Bullets at the time and the Spurs. They gave them like a little slice of their careers, and as weird as it sounds, you know, yes, it's great when we can have a John Stockton who plays his whole career, super long career with one team, but it's also kind of cool when a guy who is an established legend goes and plays for a few other teams at the end of his career and introduces himself to a fan base. And Moses is one of my favorite players of all time, and I'll always love that he and Dominique both did that to some degree, where they gave teams like the Celtics, who had been Celtics fans, hated Dominique Wilkins. And Dominique ends up being the best player, or at least the second best player on a playoff team for the Celtics in one of their lowest moments as a franchise. And that to me is just really cool. And that was something that was happening a little more often back in the 90s than it does now, I think.
Yeah, and really for the first time at that point, that's really, for free agency is even bigger there. I mean, there definitely were, trades, and even into the 80s, there was, that was when free agency really started to pick up. But I think even more in the 90s, especially with some of these guys with the end of their careers, their main team sort of uses loose for them, but these guys are also playing to an older age than they previously had been. So, and there are also more franchises now. There's more opportunities for teams to be like, he'll sell some tickets for us, sure, we'll take them, or you can help us a little bit, so that was kind of cool.
You know what would be cool? You know who could do this? And if there are any Heat fans listening, I apologize. Dwayne Wade could do this.
Oh,
because
yeah.
He doesn't quite fit what the Heat want to do moving forward. He's struggling with Goran Dragic next to him. He's beloved, and his status with the Heat is not in question. He can go somewhere else, and people are not going to hate him for it, I don't think. And it would be cool for a guy like Dwayne Wade to go and say, I want to play for, four more teams in the next 7 years. People sort of hate that concept, and that's why you see teams clinging to their players just to avoid that Patrick Ewing on the Sonics and Magic or Hakeem on the Raptors look, and I get it. But if you start a little earlier the way Dominique and Moses did, it doesn't feel as bad. Dwayne Wade can still actually give, say, the Milwaukee Bucks. He could actually be a good player for them and help them take it up a level. And that would be a little more appreciated than, what we saw with Hakeem on the Raptors, which was just always awful and weird. And
sure. Well, it's kind of, yeah, Paul, I kind of feel like it's what Paul Pierce is doing right now.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's a guy who now, when he's...
Paul
when
Pierce
it's all
is
said,
kind of doing that. You're right.
We're going to, when it's all said and done, we're going to know with Paul Pierce as a Boston Celtic, and he's going to be revered there. But you know what? Hey, he helped the Washington Wizards have a really good season, and that's fine. And he had his little spot in the Brooklyn Nets or whatever. So it's but when it's all said and done, we're going to think of him as a Boston Celtic player. He's going to be revered there. He's going to have his number retired, whatever. But it's not oh my God, he played for the Wizards. Well, forget all that he did with Boston. Forget that. Let's just move on from that now.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it doesn't cloud it too much. Two things I think we have to talk about before we get out of here. Michael Jordan returned. That was kind of cool.
Oh, we have to talk about that? All right.
Yeah, no, I don't really care. I mean, everyone else is going to talk about it in 90s all week. Right. I'm sure it'll
fair
come up
enough.
A bunch. But,
all right.
Just a quick little thing about him. Of course, the year prior, I mentioned a little bit earlier, they had done pretty well without him. Tony Kukoc came in, Scottie Pippen and Kukoc didn't really work as well together, but Pippen had a good little year. Basically, they were fine, but they didn't have the weapons to really make a big run. 94-95 didn't go quite as well. Horace Grant had left to go to the Orlando Magic. Ron Harper, who was a big guy I'd bring in, he was kind of a bust, and he wasn't really doing all that well with them. They were about .500 staggering into February. And Jordan was getting ready to go to spring training with the White Sox. The White Sox had mentioned that Jordan was probably going to go to AAA. He was going to move up the ladder, maybe get to the major leagues in 1995. Of course, the 1994 player strike was still going on. Hadn't been settled yet. There was talk of replacement players. Jordan didn't want to get caught up in that and sort of started practicing again and going to the Berto Center, the Bulls training facility. And then it all culminated in the famous words, "I'm back." And that was... interesting enough, I know there's an article about his agent, David Falk, had written a bunch of different things of, okay, how do we do this press release? What do we do to come back? Jordan hated all of it and just said, put on back, and that's all I need to do. Simple, straight to the point, don't care. And then that's it. So he kind of ripped up everything else and said, that's what we're doing. The Bulls then finished the season 13-4 with him. The season they were 47-35. They had a first-round playoff date with the Charlotte Hornets. They won that series. And then they dropped, of course, the next series to the Magic, led by Penny, Shaq, and former Bull Horace Grant. So one of the quotes that's interesting as well from Michael Jordan, it says, "We're not that far away." And of course, one year later, they would go 72-10. So very interesting there. And then the last thing I think we absolutely have to talk about, which is one of my favorite parts of this season, is the first year with the shortened three-point line. So a little background to this, a panel of 27 NBA executives voted to shorten the three-point line and add a third free throw for players that were fouled on missed three-point attempts. I forget that that wasn't a thing that like always happened. Like when I was reading that, I was like, oh, yeah.
I forgot
like,
that, I guess too. Yeah,
I was like, oh, all right. Like, and of course, all the aim was to increase league scoring and also keep defenders from packing the middle of the lane that had become a problem. With the slashing, of course, the NBA had become a very slashing league. And you also had, you know, hard fouls in the lane. And we know, or many people know, that 93-94 team was marred by a ton of, like, super aggressive fights in the playoffs. You know, the famous one of the Bulls and the Knicks, you know, fighting into the crowd, into David Stern, who's just, like, looking on like, oh, God, like, stop doing this. Like, so it was another thing, too, to sort of stop a lot of the clogging the lane, the hard fouls and that sort of stuff. Teams took advantage right away with the shortened three-point line. There was a 444 more three-point attempts in the league. There was 686 less two-point attempts. And this is averages per teams, just so you know. John Starks was clearly a big fan of the shortened three-point line. He took 611 threes that year. The year prior, he took 337. So he was feasting on that. And then in the three seasons before the shorter line, the average team scored 105.6 points per game. And then in the three seasons with the shorter line, the average team scored 100.8. So it did not help too at all what they wanted to do. Teams were taking more threes, but overall league scoring was not increasing all that much. This is a great quote from the Sun Sentinel. It's Glenn Rice. They asked Miami Heat Glenn Rice what he thought of the shortened three-point line. He says, "I guess they want me to light it up now. Maybe I'll shoot all threes this year." Glenn Rice only ended up taking 100 more threes that year, and he shot about 30% better than he did the year, or shot about 30% on threes. And despite his claim that he would only take threes, he took 952 two-pointers that year. So close, Glenn, but not quite there. But yeah, I think it's just really interesting, this idea that let's do this, let's shorten it, and that you got a lot of teams taking them, but overall the league scoring not only didn't increase in scoring, or it didn't increase, but actually in the next years prior would just plummet, and then they would just get rid of the idea because it was like, all right, well, it's not working, which would, as we know, lead to yet another just slogging years of the NBA.
One thing that's interesting about the earlier point you made about the Bulls, Horace Grant killed the Bulls in that series.
Oh, yeah.
He relished it too. Vicious. He averaged 18-11 in that series. And for the rest of the playoffs as a whole, he was only averaging like 13. So he clearly, and the Bulls didn't have a real power forward that they could lean on, because this was the 1 year between Horace leaving and Rodman arriving. You know, that's why I said it would have been cool to see the Bulls face the Rockets. It would have added some legitimacy, because the Rockets would have beaten the Bulls, because the Bulls were starting Tony Kukoc at power forward and couldn't rebound, basically. I mean, Scottie Pippen was their best rebounder, and that was why that Bulls team was not as good. It was not because Michael Jordan wasn't good, because Michael Jordan was. It was mostly because they didn't have a Horace Grant or a Dennis Rodman to anchor them down low, and then when they went up against Horace, he killed them.
Yeah, I mean, you had Dickie Simpkins like starting 12 games for that team. Like they just needed anybody that had size to just get in there and do something. And yeah, it just didn't work. And yeah, I don't have the quotes in front of me, but I know Horace was very very willing to tell people that he was dominating his former team. I don't have the quote, but I know I've seen him before. He knew what he was doing. It wasn't like, oh, weird. Against the Bulls? I don't know. Yeah, I didn't even know. Yeah.
It is funny how many of the – I mean, they didn't do much to revamp that team between 95 and 96 other than add other than Ad Rodman. I mean, they lost B.J. Armstrong. I mean, but they have Kukoc, they have Kerr, they have Longley, Purdue, and even Ron Harper, who had a pretty small role in 95. Obviously, it got bigger once he got healthier, and once you know, they kind of figured out you know, the system with everyone there. But yeah, I mean, they didn't have to do that much. Obviously, adding Rodman was a huge change, but yeah, I mean, that was a big. But as far as you know, not like they had a whole scale overhaul of the team or anything like that. I mean, they'd already basically done that from 93 to 95, and then, you know, reap the dividends the next year.
You know, Harper, Russ Bankston, former Slam editor, now with Complex, he did an interview with Harper about those years. And basically, what really stood out to me was was brought on to be the shooting guard to replace Michael. And he struggled so much with the shooting guard role in the triangle offense and being the go-to scorer in that way, which he had been good at with the Clippers and Cavs. He was a 20-point-per-game scorer with them. But he struggled with what Phil wanted him to do. Phil wanted him to be MJ. He wasn't MJ. So he – when Jordan comes back, Ron Harper is like, what am I here for? Why did I think that coming to the Bulls was such a good idea? And Phil kind of said, look, Ron – we love you, and we think that as a defensive presence at point guard, we can make you into a champion. And basically, Phil turned Ron Harper into a completely different player and then proceeded to win, what was it? I don't know if he won all three with the Lakers, but he won at least five championships.
Yeah, he won two. I know he won 2000 and 2001 with the Lakers.
That's right, yes.
He won five championships under Phil Jackson. Yeah. And sort of in the other part of that is there's this logic that the triangle needs big point guards that people keep saying, and as it relates to the Knicks, Ron Harper is the only big point guard Phil ever wanted. Phil was running Steve Kerr and B.J. Armstrong at point guard before that, and, you know, it says a lot to what Ron Harper is and what Ron Harper's legacy should be that he was so willing to say, I'm going to go from a 22 points per game guy to a 6 points per game guy, from a shooting guard to a point guard, all just to be on the same team with Michael Jordan and win some championships.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought that up. I pulled up Ron Harper's stats here to look at 93-94 with the Clippers. He shot 235 threes that year, shooting 30%. The next year with the Bulls, shortened three-point line, of course, you would assume. No, it went down to 111, yeah. 110 rather. So it was just like, yeah, you can tell just a wholesale change of how he played, how he was supposed to play. Yeah, he wasn't a slay. He was a kind of a shooter. But it didn't, yeah, it's super interesting. And then, yeah, of course, his career, we all know that. You know, he has that last year with the Clippers, great scorer, comes to the Bulls, and then just never becomes a great scorer again, but totally reinvents himself and becomes, you know, a super successful point guard. So not bad.
So what you see there is the formation. This was a really, really important year for the Bulls. It led directly into the next year, which I'm sure you guys will have a podcast that's 97% Bulls for that. Or maybe six podcasts that are 97% Bulls. But yeah, I mean, this was the year that kind of led into that. But it was the Rockets' year. So
yes, it was. It was indeed. Taller, I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl with a good, I would call it. I wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6'4". I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I was a little bit taller, y'all. Anything else that we should bring up about 1995 before we close?
I don't know if I have much. I know, of course, we talked about Penny and Shaq and just like the peak that these guys were on. I'll just really quickly do that. Penny, 23 years old. This is his first All-Star game, 20 points per game, 6.6 assists per game and 5.4 rebounds per game. And then Shaq, his third year, 22 years old, his third consecutive All-Star game. He led the NBA in points and points per game, 29.3. And then he had 11.4 rebounds per game. So you look at that as like a dominant, like 23 year old, dominating the league, all-star games too. I mean, and they had a good guys around him too. And it's just, you look at that and you're like, ah, man, it's just the fact that it never materialized in anything more than that for a multitude of reasons is definitely, it's just super interesting though. Cause you look at that power of those two guys at that point in this year as well. And it's just crazy that, you know, they're able to make the finals as well. But of course we talked about earlier, things didn't really quite work out. And then it ended up sort of spiraling out of there a little bit after that.
Yeah. And Hakeem Olajuwon's a top 10 player. And I feel like we almost should have spent more of this podcast on Hakeem Olajuwon.
that's a fair point, yes.
The podcast could be all about Hakeem, but he's a top 10 player of all time, I think.
Yeah, I kind of think he's like 11th, but it, you know, close enough. I mean, he's fantastic, obviously. And
you guys should argue for like 10 minutes about 10 versus 11. So. That'd be great if you could do that.
But regardless, he's amazing. The way that he, was able to lead the Rockets to these two championships with, he had good teammates, a great system, a great coach, but really other than, the half a season with Drexler, didn't really have another superstar along with him. And Drexler, was older and still very good, but, it wasn't like, Olajuwon, he bore so much of the burden of that team. You could even, you could definitely make the case that Olajuwon carried the Rockets more than perhaps even Jordan was carrying the Bulls championship teams with Pippen and the other guys that the Bulls had around them. It's kind of an interesting thought exercise that we probably don't have time for, but
I'll say this. Jordan in 91, 92 was very different than Jordan in 97, 98. And in 92, Jordan was doing everything.
Yeah. Well, I don't even by then, Pippen was carrying quite a load at that point. It's kind of a hard thing to measure, but you might be right that early Jordan was even doing more for that team. But I feel like, an all-star level player like Grant and a, top 50 player like Pippen, still fairly young, but by 91, he was, in pretty peak form. I think you could make that case. It's a discussion worth having anyway.
It was very good that the Rockets peaked at the exact right time to take advantage of that window, though.
Yes.
It stands out when you look at the history books is, Bulls three-peat, then Jordan leaves, and the same team takes advantage both times, like the Jazz, the Sonics, the Suns, the Blazers. They must be so bitter about that, They didn't get to take advantage. They didn't quite peak at the exact right time to take advantage of that window.
And like I said, all those teams had tremendous season that year, but obviously the Rockets were able to pull it out. So anyway, Adi, is there anything else, anything you want to tell our listeners about that you're doing that might be interested in?
Yeah, I think sporting news, we have a lot of NBA coverage, but one guy we just added is, so if you like NBA history, we have added as a contributor a couple pieces a month. Curtis Harris, who runs ProHoopsHistory.com and the Twitter handle, and he's going to write about NBA history. So check that out, too.
Yeah, he's done a great job. He's, of course, been a guest of our program several times. He's going to be on again soon, actually. So we excited for that and check this out. You guys are doing a nice job with the NBA coverage. Look at it in some interesting ways that you don't find anyplace else. I like some of Dan LaRue's stuff and some good reporting and everything. I think you got a nice mix going on there. So that's pretty cool. So you can check us out at harborparoxysm.com and you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Just search for Over and Back. If you want to leave us a rating and review, we would greatly appreciate it. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, we'll be back again soon. West.